Good afternoon, and welcome to the Green Thumb Show. I'm Lee Murray, your reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining us. From the Arizona Republic, why this Arizona garden was named best in the state by Paige Moore. HGTV has named Arizona's Desert Botanical Garden in Phoenix the most beautiful garden in the state. Arizona is known for its beautiful desert landscape, and the Desert Botanical Garden showcases Arizona's vegetation best. Since 1939, Arizona's Desert Botanical Garden has worked to preserve and conserve Arizona's desert plants. The garden spans 140 acres with five different trails, as well as 3,200 square foot butterfly pavilion. The Desert Botanical Garden offers a unique chance to explore native plants and habitats, as well as the rich indigenous history of Arizona. What to expect at the Desert Botanical Garden? The Botanical Garden explores different aspects that make Arizona unique, including its rich history and culture. The plants and people of the Sonoran Desert Trail showcases creative ways indigenous people use this desert landscape to their advantage. The trail exhibits traditional shelter structures and crops used by indigenous people. The Sonoran Desert Nature Trail explores how plants and animals survive in a desert with minimal water. Wildlife can often be found around the trail, so keep your eyes peeled. The Desert Discovery Trail is the garden's main trail, showcasing a variety of desert cactus and succulents. However, cactus is not all this garden has to offer. The Desert Wildflower Trail holds Arizona's vibrant flowers, along with the bees, butterflies, and hummingbirds that allow these flowers to thrive. The Center for Desert Living Trail also has different vegetables and herbs that grow in Arizona based on the season. The garden also has a butterfly pavilion that allows guests to walk through the exhibit and interact with butterflies. The structure features a 3,200 square foot open-air enclosure for the butterflies to roam. The enclosure hosts a variety of beautiful butterflies, including monarchs, giant swallowtails, and painted ladies. Other beautiful gardens in Arizona. Arizona is home to many other gardens, exhibiting rich culture and diverse greenery. Japanese Friendship Garden allows you to walk through a 3.5-acre garden of serenity and peace. The garden has beautiful bonsai trees and a giant pond filled with friendly koi fish to feed. Boyce Thompson Arboretum holds similar desert plants to the Desert Botanical Garden. The grounds have 12 different gardens displaying rose gardens and desert plants. The Rose Garden at MCC offers a beautiful display of around 9,000 rose bushes right outside the Mesa Community College building. Butterfly Wonderland in Scottsdale is the largest butterfly conservatory in the country. The building has been transformed into an indoor rainforest inhabited by thousands of butterflies for guests to walk through. From Phoenix Home and Garden magazine, grow miraculous moringa in the desert. Cultivate this nutritious tree in your own backyard by John Rorick. Also known as the Tree of Life and Drumstick Tree, the moringa boasts a long list of purported benefits that have garnered attention from nutritionists all over the world. Ounce for ounce, the leaves of this drought-tolerant tree have 7 times more vitamin C than oranges, 4 times the calcium of milk, triple the potassium of bananas, and quadruple the vitamin A found in carrots. The plant's proponents believe it to be effective in treating headaches, high blood pressure, arthritis, gastric ulcers, and more, and it has been shown to boost breast milk production in lactating mothers. Powder from the plant's seeds can be used to purify water. For a tree with such health benefit claims, it has a curiously low profile in this country. Moringa is well known all over the world and is used in subsistence farming in more than 20 countries, where it is the sole nutrient for some communities, says Suzanne Bellardi, a wholesale propagator who specializes in heirloom edible crops suitable for Maricopa County's harsh climate. It's just here in the U.S. where it's still relatively unknown. Native to India, moringa thrives in hot, arid regions, making it a natural choice for Arizona gardeners. The only real hazard the tree faces is freezing temperatures, but even when damaged by frost, it can be cut down to ground level and will bounce back once warm weather returns, growing as much as 18 feet high in a 6-month period. It's a great plant for beginners because it takes a lot of abuse, says Velarde. You could pretty much neglect a moringa tree and it will be just fine. Velarde describes a mature moringa tree as slender and graceful with delicate leaves. I wouldn't recommend it as an ornamental addition to a landscape, she says. There is a dwarf variety that grows to about 6 feet high that I have seen planted as a hedge, but as it goes dormant and loses its leaves in the winter, the visual appeal is diminished, she says. Valley chef Aaron Chamberlain discovered the plant at the Ahwatukee Farmers Market 6 years ago. He raves, I'm always looking for food-related plant-based medicine that I can incorporate into my home garden, he says. Moringa is so easy to grow, it's a no-brainer. I initially planted 4 trees. They came up so quickly, I had more produce than I knew what to do with. After the first 6 months, I dried 8 full sheet pans of the leaves on my back patio. While the leaves are the most commonly consumed part of the plant, both fresh from the tree and dried and ground into powder, the moringa's pods are also a popular ingredient in Indian and Asian cuisines. Scottsdale resident Jack Davis learned about moringa when she and her husband were researching permaculture gardening, the practice of developing sustainable and self-sufficient agricultural ecosystems. We wanted an edible plant that is fast-growing and that can provide a shade canopy. Moringa fit the bill, she says. After watching the seedlings grow literally before their eyes, the couple juiced the fresh leaves and discovered ingestion can have a cleansing effect. Based on our experience, we would recommend not consuming a large amount right from the start, she says. The key is to use moringa sparingly until you know how your body will react. Davis describes the moringa's flavor as spicy, similar to mustard or horseradish. While her favorite method of preparation is adding the young seed pods, which resemble string beans, to curry dishes, she also sprinkles the leaves into soups and garnishes salads and stir-fries with a dusting of the powder. Additionally, she notes that moringa flowers, profusions of which generally bloom here in July and November, are also consumable. The blossoms are very fragrant, but still carry the plant's spiciness, she notes. We like to sauté them with onions and add them to omelets, frittatas, and scrambled eggs. After experimenting in his own kitchen, Chamberlain prefers to pulverize the dried leaves into a powder for use as a dietary supplement. In the beginning, I tried all kinds of things, he recalls. I experimented with different dishes, but I found that the flavor can be overpowering. I add 1 ounce to my morning smoothie, along with blueberries, ginger, turmeric, dates, and hemp seeds. I also make tea by boiling the fresh leaves in water for a few minutes. Given its rapid growth rate, moringa should be placed in an open area where it won't interfere with other greenery or structures. If grown in a pot, expect a limited lifespan, Velarde says. This plant has a taproot almost like a carrot, she says. If contained, the root will become damaged by winding around the bottom of the pot, limiting the growth and lifespan of the plant. There's no reason why you couldn't grow a small tree in a container and enjoy its benefits, but know that it will only last for a single season. You can always start a new one in the spring. Moringa byproducts, including oil, extract, powder, tea bags, and capsules, are available online and through health food specialty grocery stores. Although very few side effects have been reported, researching benefits and cautions is important, and consulting a physician is recommended before adding any supplement to your diet. Velarde is an avid proponent of growing and harvesting moringa in lieu of purchasing commercially available products. The benefits you get from what you grow yourself will always be greater than something you buy in a plastic container at a grocery store. Now here are some growing tips by Bruce Solomon from our Arcadia Color Garden. For best results, grow moringa from seed or seedling. Stem cuttings tend to develop a shallow root system, resulting in a more fragile tree structure. Plant in early spring once danger of frost has passed. Seeds should be placed in soil about 1 inch deep and kept moist while germinating. An ideal location receives at least 4 hours of direct sun daily. Moringa will also thrive in full sun. Moringa leaves will wilt when they need water. Provide a good soaking when soil surface looks dry but is slightly damp at a depth of 1 inch. Irrigate potted plants until water comes out of the container's drainage hole. Keep trees at a height at which leaves and seed pods can be easily accessed. When pruning, cut a half inch above a leaf node to encourage branching. From the Arizona Republic, ChatGPT was used to design Cottage Garden by Jennifer Jolly. From plant maps to fall planting tips, here's how I use ChatGPT to design a lush, deer-resistant cottage garden in my specific zone without hiring a landscaper. You know that feeling when you get a quote and think, wait, how much? That was me staring at an estimate of $12,500 to turn the barren rock and weed-smattered dirt patch in front of my house into a dreamy cottage garden. Enter my new favorite AI hack, using ChatGPT as a landscape architect. And a spoiler, I spent just over $2,000 and ended up with a yard that looks like it belongs in a magazine spread. The project. I worked with a 465-square-foot front bed, curved, partial sun, and frequented by deer like it's their neighborhood salad bar. The pros wanted thousands for design fees, plant selection, and installation. I wanted deer-resistant, low-maintenance, drought-tolerant plants suited to my Pacific Northwest Zone 8B and a price tag that didn't feel like a second mortgage. The AI factor. I uploaded photos and dimensions to ChatGPT and typed, "Help me landscape this with deer-proof, drought-resistant plants for my zip code on a $2,000 budget. Include a map and grid layout. Then show me where to buy these plants for the least amount of money within 50 miles. What happened next felt like HGTV crossed with Silicon Valley. ChatGPT generated full planting plans with plants perfect for Zone 8B. Lavender, hydrangeas, catmint, salvia, heuchera, and ornamental grasses, and told me exactly where each should go, back row, middle, front border. It broke down spacing 5 to 6 feet between lavenders, suggested existing boxwoods as anchors, and even reminded me about mulch. I printed out its 7-page plan and sent my 2 best research assistants, my parents, to confirm everything with a real-life expert. Priscilla, a garden guru at Mallard's Landing Nursery in Oak Harbor, Washington, reviewed the plan and confirmed that every detail, right down to bark mulch color, was spot on. The timeline, days 1 through 2, were all about bed prep, weed barrier, new soil, and shovel workouts that made me regret skipping arm day. Day 3 was nursery runs. ChatGPT found local shops, compared wholesale versus retail, and coached me on how to get wholesale prices without a contractor's permit. Days 4 through 5 were layout, planting, and mulching days. This included about an hour of me uploading progress photos to the ChatGPT app with questions like, where does the catmint go? Do I space lavenders 5 or 6 feet apart? It was like gardening with a patient friend who never rolled their eyes. AI nailed the details and answered every single question. I'm careful to triple check that it's not hallucinating, and it really was incredibly accurate. It even assured me that fall's the perfect time to do a project just like this in my area because cooler temps and steady rain help roots establish before winter. Everything gets a strong start and bursts to life in spring. If I'd planted in summer, half might have crisped up before settling in. Here's how the budget broke down. Soil and mulch, $400. Plants, lavender, hydrangeas, catmint, grasses, perennials, and shrubs, about $1,400. Extras, like fertilizer and deer repellent spray, came in around $200. Total, right around that $2,000 mark. That's more than $10,000 less than hiring a pro. So why this matters? This isn't just about one yard. It's about how AI is quietly transforming everyday life, even cottage gardening. Landscaping used to be an opaque, high-cost mystery. Now, tools like ChatGPT make professional-level design accessible to anyone with Wi-Fi and a free weekend. It doesn't dig the holes, yet, but it bridges the gap between expert knowledge and do-it-yourself reality. People are using AI for everything, kids, study schedules, trip planning, business marketing, and now backyard makeovers. Knowledge that once required hiring a professional is suddenly open source, personalized, and affordable. I saved over $10,000, got a customized climate-appropriate garden plan, learned more about lavender spacing than I ever wanted to know, and ended up with a space that makes me smile every time I pull in the driveway. My neighbors think I hired a pro crew. Nope, just a lot of mulch, sweat, family elbow grease, and an AI sidekick. If you've been wondering whether AI can do something useful beyond writing weird poems or fake Drake songs, this is proof. From potty training to vacation planning to turning a dirt lot into a lush garden, AI is quickly becoming the handy robot friend we didn't know we needed. So yes, I could have spent $12,500. Instead, I spent a fifth of that, planted at exactly the right time of year, got a full body workout, and learned my new favorite phrase, where does the catmint grow? And to underscore the importance of bees, here's a fun fact from Fox News Digital. A honeybee visits between 50 and 100 flowers during one collection flight from the hive. In order to produce 1 pound of honey, 2 million flowers must be visited. From ArizonaPlantLady.com, desert willow, a beautiful flowering tree for the desert garden. I didn't start out planting them all at once. 25 years ago, when our home was being built, I knew that I wanted a desert willow, and it was one of the first trees we added. It is the common species, but it is doing well and anchors the back corner of the backyard wall. My second one has white flowers, which is rather rare. It's called Hope, and I planted it from a 4-inch pot 8 years ago that I bought from a mail-order nursery. It's taken a while for it to grow, and I love its decorative beauty. The leaves are smaller and narrower, so are the flowers compared to other varieties of desert willow. Number 3 and 4 were planted about 5 years ago and are my most favorite in regard to their shape and flower color. Bubba is arguably the most popular variety with its bubblegum pink flowers. It also has a nice rounded canopy. Timeless Beauty was also added 5 years ago. It has very deep green foliage and dark pink flowers. I don't care for its natural shape as much as other varieties. If given a choice, I'd choose one of the several varieties that have Bubba in their name. 2 years ago, I added 3 more desert willow trees to help add shade in areas where a large tree wouldn't fit. Bubba Jones had light pink blooms and more of a tree-like shape. And to finish out my Bubba collection, I have a sweet Bubba in my side yard where it will provide afternoon shade for my dwarf orange tree. So why do I have so many? Well, there are several reasons. First, they thrive in the heat, even through our hotter summers. I love their bright green foliage, which feels to me like a visual oasis spring, summer, and fall. The flowers that appear in spring and summer, they are so colorful and hummingbirds love them. Because they are small to medium-sized trees, they can be used in areas where space is limited. And you don't have to buy a large size since they grow quickly. I planted all of mine from 15-gallon nursery containers. Here are some more stats. Native to the desert southwest, drought tolerant, although supplemental water keeps it looking its best. My trees are connected to my irrigation drip system. Hardy to 0 degrees Fahrenheit. Flowers spring through fall. Although not a willow, it does have willow-shaped leaves. Grows quickly and reaches a mature size of approximately 25 feet high and wide. Thornless and easy to maintain. Plant in full sun and well-drained soil. They are deciduous, meaning that they will lose their leaves in winter, and they do form seed pods. And the flowers range from pale pink to purple in the wild. Today, there are many varieties to choose from, many of which are seedless or nearly seedless, which means lower litter. I encourage you to try desert willow in your landscape. You will appreciate their beauty and heat resilience. And those of you who are regular listeners to this show know we feature stories each week from the terrific book, Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. This story is called To Diana with Love, from Canada, by Susan Adler. And there's a quote here from Colin Powell. The best method of overcoming obstacles is the team method. To Diana with Love, from Canada. The death of Diana, Princess of Wales, left me in shock. I was watching TV when the announcement of her car crash was made. Completely stunned, almost numb, I followed the coverage throughout the week that led to her Saturday funeral. That week was also one of non-stop work. I'm the executive director of the Composting Council of Canada, and it's a very busy job. We were facing a lot of deadlines at the time, and our to-do list seemed to get longer by the day. At the same time, I was dealing with my own reaction and that of everyone else to the loss of Diana. Canada is still part of the British Commonwealth, and much of the country feels a deep kinship with Britain. The loss hit us very hard. Here in Toronto, people began placing flowers, cards, candles, and other remembrances in front of the Princess of Wales Theatre, a theatre that a few years ago had been named in Diana's honor. Each time I passed the theatre that week, I stopped and looked at all the notes and photos and flowers being left there. It had become somewhat of a shrine in her memory, a place for people to come and pay their respects. I awoke early on Saturday to watch her funeral and the procession that followed on television. Once it was over, I caught myself thinking about how she had made a difference for so many and what an impact her death had on everyone. My mind then skipped to all the flowers placed at the Princess of Wales Theatre. What was going to happen to them? Sure, the ones that were still fresh could be given away, but what about those that had been there for most of the week and had already begun to turn? It suddenly hit me. We should get those flowers and have them composted. As part of my job, I spend a lot of time convincing people that organic materials such as fallen leaves, garden debris, and food scraps should be composted and used to improve the quality of the soil, not thrown into the garbage. Suddenly, composting those flowers became a way for me to do something that I believed in, and somehow, I sensed it could also become a fitting tribute to Diana. I had to find the owners of the theater, Ed and David Mervich, and convince them to let the flowers be composted. I called the theater, but all I could do was leave a message on the answering machine. I drove there, but the attendant could only suggest I leave my business card for the manager. The weekend passed, but no word came. On Monday, buried in work, I asked my colleague Lynn to try phoning again. She came back with a partial answer. We would have to write a letter to Ed Mervich explaining what we wanted to do with the flowers. Apparently, he had already received hundreds of suggestions. I panicked. I had absolutely no time to write that letter, but if I didn't do it then and there, the chance would be lost forever. First, though, I called the farm of one of the members of the council to ask if they would compost the flowers. They agreed, but asked that we deliver the flowers ready for composting. That meant that we would have to remove plastic wrap and any other non-organic materials. Then I turned to the letter. I asked Mr. Mervich to let us compost the flowers. I told him we would then use the compost to plant a tree in Diana's memory the following spring. That finished, I faxed it off and rushed back to work. About an hour later, there was a shout in our office. Miss Mervich had faxed us back to say that our idea was wonderful. The flowers were ours for the taking. We were thrilled, but then we went back to work and forgot about it. We had so much to do. At 3 o'clock that afternoon, we got the call to come and pick up the flowers. For me, the world stopped with that phone call. I hadn't planned on getting the flowers that day. We barely had time to do what we were supposed to be doing. And so, like so many other times when my life had gotten rough, I phoned home. "Dad," I said, "we need help. We have the chance to compost all those flowers at the Princess of Wales Theatre, but we need to pick them up today. Can you please go rent a van for us?" "How big a van?" he replied. "Oh, I don't know. Just one of those cube-shaped vans. I'm sure it'll be big enough. We'll plan on going down there around 6 o'clock. We can park right outside the theater and get it done in no time." Get it done in no time. What a small, naive phrase for what lie ahead. Just before 6 o'clock, Dad picked up Lynn and me. "Let's take a few bags for the flowers," I said. "We should be finished by 7:30. When we drove up to the curb by the theater, the three of us suddenly got quiet. Very quiet. There they were. Diana's flowers, hundreds and hundreds of bundles. They made a wall that must have stretched 50 feet long and 2 feet high. Never did I anticipate such a huge amount. "Well, I guess we better get started," Dad said. And so we did. Almost every bundle was wrapped in plastic. We removed all of it by hand, without gloves. Given all the roses, gloves would have been nice, but I hadn't thought of that. People passed us, heading out for the evening, and asked what we were doing. Some even stood and watched. As the time passed, our eagerness to explain ourselves waned. There was so much to do. It was now past 8 p.m. and beginning to get dark. Despite nonstop work, we hadn't even made a dent in the wall of flowers. I started to panic. We would never get this done. What had I got us into? We needed help. I called a local radio station to ask for volunteers. They agreed to announce it on their 8:30 news. That done, we went back to work. In a little while, a big car pulled up beside us. A tall man in a security uniform got out. Oh, great, I thought. Somebody heard this on the radio and is coming down to check us out. This was not going to be good. We had no permission papers. The theater was closed. I silently promised myself that I would never again do anything that I didn't have to do. Oh, well, if he's going to kick us out, let him make the first move, I thought. The security guard walked up. I heard about you on the radio, he said. I drew my breath. I just got off work. I'm here to help. If I had known him better, I would have given him a big hug. And then others started to show up. Dozens and dozens of people. They came from all over Toronto to help. Before long, the theater curb was crowded with willing volunteers. By 11 p.m., we were finally done. Despite the late hour, no one seemed in a hurry to go home. Everyone needed to talk about Diana, to share their grief and shock. Many people were still talking outside of the theater when Dad, Lynn, and I finally said goodbye. The next day, Dad and one of our staffers drove the flowers up to the farm that would do the composting. Then it was back to our work at the council. The compost wouldn't be ready until spring. That April, as we prepared to plant our memorial tree, we began receiving requests from all over the country. Schoolchildren, mayors, leaders of other provinces, all over Canada, people wanted to plant trees using the compost made from those flowers. What had started out as personal gestures of respect for Diana at the time of her death became a wellspring of celebrations of her life and legacy. A chance for thousands of people to symbolically compost their grief and turn it into something good. That spring, more than 100 trees were planted in Canada in Diana's honor, and every one was graced with a bit of compost from the flowers that had been placed in her memory in front of the Princess of Wales Theatre in Toronto. That's called To Diana with Love from Canada, written by Susan Adler, one of the many stories that make up Chicken Soup for the Gardener's Soul. And that's the Green Thumb Show for this week. For Sun Sounds Radio, I'm Lee Murray, your reader. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. Be safe and healthy. And we'll be talking with you soon.